Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
You know what I love about this? You could never tell they were rich. It's all so classy and understated.
I'll make it up to you later.
Make it up to me now. Let's find a room. They must have a few.
You're so bad. It is what rich, entitled people do when threatened. They conceal the ugly truths to protect themselves.
The community is in shock tonight over the gruesome discovery of a fourth-grade mother found bludgeoned to death.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching The Undoing. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you are just joining us on this podcast, what we like to do every week, Richard and I, is pick a show that we're watching closely, obsessively, and break down the latest episode. We are currently on episode 4 of The Undoing, which is called, I believe, See No Evil. So that is what we will be discussing today. We will not be discussing any further episodes because Richard hasn't seen them. I've only seen one more after this, so we're getting close to my... me being equally as in the dark as you are, Richard.
As undone.
Oh, as equally
as undone. They say the title of the show in this episode, sort of.
I will be wandering the streets of New York in various velvet coats, just looking undone. You can always email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. I sort of implored folks to email us last week, and we were richly rewarded for that. So I want to say... that I'm gonna see if I can get away with this, playing this through my microphone, and if I can't, I'm just gonna send Dave this clip so that he can insert it for us. But our listener Catherine made actually like a video about something that happened in last week's episode that she thought was really funny. So this is about episode 3. I'm gonna play this for you. I don't know if it's gonna come through as a. It's an audio element. Here we go.
I never underestimate the state's ability to fuck things up. I can win almost any case, Grace. What I cannot do is wave a wand and make everything better.
That, of course, is the voice of the great Noma Demeswini, who plays Haley, the lawyer. She also, as we discussed last week, played Hermione in the Harry Potter play The Cursed Child, which is in London and also on Broadway. And she said, I can't wave a magic wand. And the video that Catherine sent to us, unfortunately, you guys listening can't see it, but it like cuts to a photo of her as Hermione and then cuts to like video footage of Catherine herself with her hand over her mouth. So anyway, I love an undoing meme. So thank you so much for that. Then we got this email from Carlos, which is kind of extensive, so bear with me. I'm quite enjoying The Undoing and your coverage of it, so I figured I'd drop you a line with a few thoughts both on the show and your discussions. Here are a few points that really caught my attention in the show, but I don't think you guys mentioned. Unreliable narrators. In the third podcast episode, you mentioned how Grace might be an unreliable narrator. I think that'll totally turn out to be the case. The question is whether she's just unaware of it, some psychological denial, or just really good at lying, as in maybe because Kidman's so good at acting for us, Grace is selling it just as well to Detective Mendoza, if that makes any sense. For now, I'm leaning on the former, but we'll have to see. However, I did think it was very suspicious that in episode 2, when first talking to the detectives, Grace was super vague regarding her connection with Elena. It would have been normal for her to mention that Elena seemed upset when she left, but she makes it sound like they barely met each other. So why is she hiding that? If I remember correctly, that exchange happens before it becomes obvious that Jonathan's a suspect. Makes me wonder. Then Carlos, the next heading for Carlos is dodgy family. I also think that anyone in the family might have played a role in this. Agreed that Henry could be hiding something when he was so reassuring to Grace in episode 2 when she was worrying about not being able to reach Jonathan. That could just be him being a nice son or trying to buy his dad some time. Same goes for Grace's dad, Franklin. I don't think you guys discussed that quick scene in episode 3 where we see him lurking outside the Alves' apartment. What was that about? I also feel like when he was being so upset about not telling Grace about the loan to Jonathan, that might have been crocodile tears. It seems like it'd be too obvious for Jonathan to have done that. But if he'd only intended to confront Elena the night of the murder, why had he made up that conference in advance to give himself a cover for the whole next day? The next title is Prison Chic. Also in episode 3, I know Grace is rich and privileged and under a lot of stress, but who on earth would wear an extravagant crimson velvet coat to a prison visit? And then the last thing is the others vibes. Carlos says, lastly, I enjoyed how you guys discussed how the show is giving you throwback vibes to Kidman's earlier work. I think you name checked Dead Calm or Far and Away. I got huge the others vibes. I love that movie. In episode 2, when Grace wakes up at night to some clattering noise in the lake house, plus her character in the others was also named Grace. Maybe this Grace is a ghost. Would love to hear your thoughts on any of this. Keep up the good work. So, sorry, big spoiler for the others at the end of that email. If you haven't seen that great film, Richard, do you have any thoughts on coats or Donald Sutherland or anything else that was mentioned in this email?
Well, of course, all my thoughts on coats you can listen to on our other podcast, Still Coding. So I'll save them for that podcast. I think this is a timely email because this episode, I think, really goes in much more in depth to the potential unreliability of Grace's quote unquote narration. I mean, she's not narrating the show, but she is our protagonist. And we assume, because we are trained by various semiotic things or just like literary tradition, to trust her. You know, I think there was obviously the anxiety attack that was immediately preceded by like what looked like some kind of hallucination or something. And also, yeah, I think that the caginess that she has with the detectives at first just seemed like she, you know, that kind of like, oh, well, I'm not going to give them something they can rope to hang me with. But now it's like, why are you being so evasive? Like,
right.
There's so many easy explanations for things. Well, my husband said she was obsessed with you. That's why she called me. I don't know her. You know, but she's instead cursing, you know, at the police, and which, you know, maybe we should all be doing, but like, but in this context, like, it's like you could do so much more to seem innocent and she's not. And obviously her conversation with the lawyer, who clearly does not trust her. We also see Franklin really kind of bare his teeth in a way that we haven't seen, and see how much we see more clearly how he functions in this family and as a sort of dominant, you know, mucky muck of New York life. I think there is definitely more than meets the eye to this whole family, but I still don't know who to pin it on exactly.
Yeah, no, I think that's we'll get more into it. But I feel like if this episode is trying to do anything, it's really trying to push the could Franklin have done it narrative into the forefront, would be my assessment. Mike emailed us some feedback on episode 3, our interview with Edgar Ramirez, where he said he enjoyed the interview. And in that interview, Richard, if you didn't get a chance to hear me talk to your boyfriend, Edgar talked about both like the research he did, you know, talking to real homicide detectives, and the fact that the actor who plays his partner is a former cop. So like the idea of like, you know, what they looked into. But Mike disagrees with one aspect. He says one point of disagreement in real life homicide detectives would be treating Grace with the utmost courtesy. So Mike feels like, you know, these cops are not being as kid glovey to Kidman as they would have been in real life. All right. And then this email comes from Catherine, who says, Throwing out some theories, maybe one ends up sticking. First, joining whatever chorus may already exist and thinking that Donald Sutherland is behind it. I don't think he did it himself, but orchestrated it. It would track to me that Jonathan would have confessed the affair / love child to Franklin in the conversation about getting the money, and Franklin waved an "I'll take care of it" wand and hired someone to do the kill and is now framing Jonathan for it to protect Grace. The other thought was that he's in cahoots with Grace, but I'll be mad if that bears out, because then it's clumsy thing where they've had conversations in private that we haven't been shown. So it really wouldn't work that they both know and are hiding it. But if Grace really wasn't involved in the actual doing of it, she's still hiding something, given that she was there that night. My theory on that is that what she isn't saying is that she was actually the first person to find Elena's body and didn't go to the police. And I'd imagine her reason for not telling the police is connected to how / why she ended up at the studio, because obviously that can't be a coincidence, even if she knew Elena lived in Harlem. But honestly, the reveal I'm most wishing for is that Lily Rabe is married to, like, Cherry Jones. Sylvia is the show for me. Thanks for reading. And then Catherine says, sorry, one more. Sylvia casually mentioning in episode 2 that Jonathan came to her for legal advice plus loaded glances in the courtroom equals they slept together, or it's like Dr. Foster, where way more people knew about Elena than Grace realized. So I don't know if you guys have seen Dr. Foster. I definitely have. It's a great British soapy time. Richard, any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I'm glad that they brought up Sylvia, because she has an interesting scene in this episode where she and Franklin interact, and there seems to be an affection passing between them. Maybe it's just because Sylvia is such good friends with Grace. But it had me thinking, coupled with this anxiety attack or whatever it actually was, that maybe this entire family and friend unit is all protecting Grace from herself, from the police. Maybe they all know that she went into some sort of fugue state and did something and are all working in concert to protect her. Whether that means Henry's involved in it or what, but like, I think there are some holes in that theory and some messiness to it, but the show, I don't think it was just an accident or a toss off that we got to see not only Franklin as he deals with problems of, you know, at the school or with Jonathan, but that scene with Sylvia, it feels like that was there for a reason.
Yeah, I asked Lily Rabe about that when I talked to her. I don't think it made it into the final interview that went on air because of the timing of it. But I thought that exchange was so interesting. Her, like, have fun to him. And it just, you know, she's just sort of like, they're similar people, Franklin and Sylvia, that they, like, once again, they like disrupting the circles of power. This is something that Lily Rabe talked about a lot, about Sylvia and, like, how she and Grace are kind of in this world but outside this world. And Sylvia, like, you know, Sylvia, a childhood friend of Grace's, has known Franklin her whole life and gets a kick out of watching him swing his power around, and maybe she enjoys doing the same thing. So,
which, you know, and I think that might speak to, if it really is just kind of illustrative of, like, Sylvia's place in this ecosystem, that might speak to, like, a less about the whodunit and more to, like, the themes of this show. You know, I think, which are so clearly stated by Haley, the lawyer, when, you know, she's saying that because that's what rich people do. They, you know, they withhold because they think they can get away with it. And, you know, Sylvia saying have fun or whatever, like this whole thing of, well, we think we're good people,
yeah,
but we enjoy the power that we wield and maybe just don't think about the ramifications of that, and that other people don't have this, but, or maybe knowing that other people don't have it is part of the fun, you know? And, yeah, and it's just saying, how moral can you really be if you are so comfortable in such a casual way, offhanded way, of pulling the strings and levers of power, and clearly, at least Haley is keen to that sort of immorality, but does not mind working within it and working for it.
That is a perfect segue. We actually have two interviews for the podcast this week. We've got Noma Demeswani, which we will go to right now. And then later in the episode, we've got Ismael Cruz Cordova, whose character Fernando had a sort of big scene this episode. So since we have two, we'll drop one now and get to the other later. So let's hear from Noma on her character, Haley. Hey, I wanted to say before we got into this show how much I just adored your work on Normal People. I just wept through that whole episode, and I just thought you were incredible. So I just
I really appreciate that, Joanne, and I will absolutely give kudos to the amazing Hetty McDonald, the director, because she was just sublime, and therefore working with the young and great Paul Mescal. It was just lovely. It was a lovely, it's very easy to listen to people when they're doing great work. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of listening that you do in this show as well, in a different profession. I want to start by asking you something that I've kind of decided to ask everyone, which is, what is your interpretation of the title of this series?
The Undoing.
The Undoing. What's undone?
I think it's my interpretation of that title is, we do what we do, but that can become a habit. And then for it to be undone, undoes you. And therefore you have to look at the world in a different way. Mm-hmm. The undoing of people's shapes, forms, environments, structures, emotionally and physically, culturally. And that's really what we're all going through at the moment as well, the undoing. And the phrase I like is that actually, I think we're all unfolding. I mean, that's a different answer to your question, but in terms of the undoing, we have to look at where we all are. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what Grace and Jonathan have to do.
So I'm curious, when you first encountered your character on the page, did you have an interpretation of her that was different from any discussions discussions with Susanna about the material, about the work?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when I first encountered Hayley, you remember everything starts with oneself. Every story starts with oneself, and then now you shift it and change it, becomes something. And I like to work in collaboration with people. And I always say that Susanna kind of course corrected me to kind of go, no, this is the Hayley I would like to see. But I think the Hayley I kind of came in with, like this, and I've just done this, so she's obviously going to be big, and blah, 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 blah. But actually, what I loved was what Susanna was pushing. And I can say this now from a distance, because I did find it intense at the time, but from a distance, I love the holding and stillness and quietness of Hayley. And she's a watcher and she's a listener. But there was an interesting thing that Susanna made me do, just speak quieter, speak quieter. I was like, I can't speak quietly, I'm just coming, kind of feeling.
Right.
Actually, there is a power in kind of just letting people come towards you and not have to push yourself, because you're very comfortable in your space. And that's what I loved about Hayley, her confidence. I really did like that. Yeah. So that was learning that alongside Susanna, going, yeah, let's push that more that way. So just to get her still up.
It's interesting to me, you know, the function that your character serves at one point, at least in the series, is to throw into doubt our theories, our personal theories on who might have done it, right? That's the whole job, is to gum up the works.
Absolutely, she said that. Yeah.
And you know, that to a certain extent is sort of like what the show is trying to do at any given moment, is sort of like throw us in one direction or the other. So did you think of your character, I don't know since you're thinking of your character as a human, do you think of your character also as a sort of larger representation of this genre, this like twisty mystery genre?
I think what you're going to do for me in that sense, do I think of my character in this genre? I think of her as a human being, and then I listen and read what David E. Kelly has written, or if there's slight rewrites, why have they changed to that? And then you're working with Nicole and Hugh and kind of listen to the thoughts that may be behind a moment and that could change. And then when they do a thing, another thing flips, because emotionally they've given something else. So ultimately, I would say, I think the answer is, I held onto Hayley as a human being who is watching and listening. She knows her job inside out really well. And she says she puts the burden of proof on the law. And that's why she creates muck very early on. So therefore, you've got to work it out. The law has to work it out. And that is part of the thriller narrative. That is part of the, I'm that good at my job that I can go, what do you think? And right. I like that. So they kind of, I understand your question. They kind of collide, but I have to think of Hayley as a human being.
Of course, yeah. As a performer. Yeah, that makes sense to me. What does it feel like as a performer to approach a legal drama written by David Kelly, who is sort of our foremost legal drama guy, you know?
Well, first and foremost, you can trust it. Mm-hmm. First and foremost, you can trust it. And you also understand that this is a drama. This is a storytelling narrative. It's not the real thing. And even speaking to people who were the real thing and the real thing in the course, you go, well, this is TV. This is TV. Because ultimately, we're storytellers and we want to engage in a point of view. And the narrative is not about the courtroom. Ultimately, for me, it's about these people. It's about Grace. It's about Jonathan. It's about the world that they're in and the undoing of that world. And here I am, a character who comes in and serves that narrative in one way. And then you've got somebody like Ishmael's character, Mr. Alves, who serves it in another way. And that's ultimately, the writing is great. We come back always. Shakespeare, David E. Kelly, great narrators of storytelling, Afra Behn, Toni Morrison, do you know what I mean? Whoever is telling the story, mm-hmm. and me as an audience goes, oh, I want to know more, then the job's done. And that's what I want to be part of.
I was speaking to Hugh Grant this morning, and he was sort of expressing that he was appalled by some of the realities that he learned about the American legal system in terms of the relationship to the media, or, you know, just the larger circus aspect of it. Yeah. Did you have a similar experience working on this?
I think when you realize that's quite early on, we did a scene talking to the media, and the reason for why she did it is about changing a narrative. I was like, rah. I mean, when you do go deeply into it, you go, wow, okay. Mm-hmm. That's a way of using information. But I have to also say as well, though, right now, Joanna, we're witnessing something quite extraordinary in how the media and the world is being shown in itself. And I kind of go, do you want nothing now? I'm sure a lot of things will surprise me, but when the unfolding of us human beings in this moment in time is that a lot of light has been shown into dark underbellies and shadows and crevices and nooks. And you go, wow, okay. So that thing about the law is an ass. The law can be an ass, but if you know how to use the law well, it will absolutely work in your favor.
Yeah.
If you have means to do it.
If you have a Hayley on your side, right?
Yeah, if you have a Hayley on your side, yeah.
You mentioned some small rewrites. Can you share anything, however small, that might have
altered?
No. 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 I'm not trying to pry secrets.
Yeah, okay, great. Do you know what? I will say, I think there was one moment that a scene took away. It was a really small scene, and we realized actually in the narrative, the overarching narrative, we didn't quite need it. And it was a courtroom, the anteroom scene between Grace and Jonathan and Hayley. And it was actually, what was lovely was watching Nicole and Hugh, for me as an actor, watching them trying to figure out the overall arc of where their story was going in terms of this particular scene. For me, for Hayley, it actually didn't matter in terms of the arc of the story. So it was about the bigger picture for them. So it was wonderful watching the two of them with Susanna try and go, yes, 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 no, no, no. Do we actually know what? We can let it go. And I love that. I love that in that moment when we're ready, you can actually, we don't need it. We don't need, because they've got the bigger picture going on. And therefore, I remember, do I need? No, actually, that's fine. You always have to come back to your character and say, what do I need out of this? But it was lovely watching that thought process.
I'm curious. I know that Susanna has a reputation for doing a lot of coverage and also a lot of sort of unusual coverage, because there's so many interesting, almost avant-garde sort of close-ups and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, what was your experience with that as a performer?
It was just trusting, just do the scene. She's going to do the coverage wherever she needs to do it. And also, for me, it was a very intense, steep learning curve is what I was going to say. And it was that shift from theatre through to TV. Yes, I've done bits of theatre and bits of TV and film along the way in the last few years. And the biggest one before that was Black Earth Rising in terms of a narrative character that goes through. So a lot of the stuff I've done has been like normal people appearing here for the moment there. So with Hayley and working with Susanna and how it was, all I just went, which is what I always have to do, who are the actors I'm working with? The director knows what they want to film, however many setups they want to do, and we can organize that. But as long as the truth of the connection with the characters is going on, there were some technical moments you're trying to figure out, and you kind of go, okay, I actually can't see someone's eyes because there's a camera right in front of my face, but I've got to imagine right. them there. But one's imagination is good enough to do that if you understand the story telling. So for me, that technicality, watching that technicality occur around me, the wires, the ropes of wires, the lights, the beams, the things like that, going, this is so different. And I'm just used to an audience being right there. And I love that. This is a new thing. So my curiosity, I just love it. It's a new learning curve.
Do you feel like that calibration that Susanna was looking for with your character for more stillness, all of that, is that related to you being a theatrical actor and used to playing
absolutely
to the rafters? And she's like, she's like, guess what? My camera's right here. You don't need to do
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And actually, the microphone can pick up so much more.
Right.
Like, so I'm still doing this. So I had this image, and I remember apologizing to Danny when I finally figured it all out. Danny was our sound designer. I remember going, I'm so sorry for shouting in your ears those early days when I was doing it. I'm really sorry. And he kind of laughed and was like, it's okay. Because that was my learning curve. And I remember it was actually another friend who said to me, who was in the business, it said, it was a lovely note that I got outside of it when I was trying to figure out what was I not doing right. Because I was still stuck in a theater energy space. Mm-hmm. And my lovely friend, Alexa, who is a casting director, went, just speak to the distance of the person you're speaking to. I'm like, huh? Speak to the distance of the person you're speaking to. It's become one of the most major notes that I could have ever had. So therefore, if someone's speaking like this, I can go really quiet, but the mic is going to pick it up. And I'm like, that's genius. So I remember coming in the next day, kind of going, I got it. I know it now. But it's those technical things that shift what you do. And therefore, with Susanna wanting me to get stiller and quieter, in a sense, the technical stuff is doing all the work. I don't need to hit the back of the room.
Right.
So that was my steep learning curve amongst many. Yeah.
Something I think that's very interesting in your section, particularly of the season, is this sort of background percolation in the news footage of this question of privilege, and specifically white privilege around the client. And I think it's interesting that you and Edgar and Ishmael are these non-white actors sort of circling this very insulated white rich world. And I was wondering, you know, what thoughts you had on what the show is trying to do with that contrast.
I think, right, so what we've got to acknowledge is I finished filming in June of last year. I think they had a few more weeks. They finished in July. The whole thing finished in July. What we're doing at that time is going, let's have, I don't know what the casting process was and the choices of the casting process. What I do know is that I got the part of Hayley Fitzgerald. Now, just that name, Hayley Fitzgerald. There's so many different types of actors you could have playing that name. I happen to be the one who got the part, and this is how I look. Post George Floyd, and everything for me is before and after. Excuse me. At the beginning of May, we're due to show The Undoing at that point. Before the George Floyd moment happened. But because of COVID and the pandemic, blah, 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 we're now doing it here, and here we all are because it's finally arriving, and I'm very excited by that. But our awareness, Joanna, your awareness has shifted. The question would have been absolutely different in January. And I know that my answer would have been totally and utterly different in January, because I don't believe we can unsee what we have seen. So therefore, now you are aware, and I mean this with love and respect, that, oh, look at that actor, and look at that actor, and look at that actor. Whereas I've not necessarily been clocking them before this moment, but they just happen to be actors of color there. But there is, we're now in a space of layering that I'm really excited about, because you as the individual, you as a human are going, oh yeah, that's interesting, because that's about class, that's about money. Mm-hmm. And you kind of go, because also for me with Hayley, I know that that route is, she is of the world, but she's not, so she knows the world, but she's not of it that she works in. That's a very expensive law firm. Mm-hmm. That's a very expensive law firm. And even going, how did she get there? And I go back to that character, her confidence, her sense of self, her sense of play, her sense of control, the scene that she has with Jonathan to try and figure out what and where and how he is and where she can put him in her scheme, because she is brilliant at what she does. She has a confidence that I don't have, and I find that fascinating. But you can't help but look at it through the filter of me playing her. Do you know what I mean? It's the same. It's almost like, I think the thing with what happened, Hermione getting that part and how that changed a narrative. Mm-hmm. But now the narrative is different again. Mm-hmm. Because we're all so much more aware, because the world has done an extraordinary thing. The world, universe has done an extraordinary thing to all as humans, if we're willing to learn the lesson. I get very romantic about that, Joanna.
No, I really appreciate that answer a lot. My last question for you is, did you receive the entire script, the whole thing, when you...
All in one go.
Okay. So you knew...
No, I didn't. No. I had a sense to say it was coming, I think, like the first few, and then... Let's put it, by the time I was filming, I knew what their overreaching arc was going to be. But even I was like, where is it coming? What's next? Oh, yeah, these ones are coming through. These ones are coming through. They had the arc there. But then stuff did change as we were doing it. And you go, I love that. Because it's not linear. So it keeps us, okay, brilliant. Because you kind of get, and then my question is, what happens in the cutting room, in the edit room? What does Susanna see? And how does that change her storytelling as well? Mm-hmm. Because it's never done until it's done. And I'm fascinated by this medium. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just interesting to me, because I heard that the extras in the courtroom were asked sort of every day who they thought had done it. And they had a different answer every day. So I was wondering if your theories had changed or anything. So,
you know, that was interesting. And from my point of view, no. But it was wonderful and glorious watching that. And that was Richard, our first AD, who would kind of get the audience, the court warmed up. And it was fascinating how it changed. It was fascinating. And when you have someone like Donald Sutherland in the room as well, mm-hmm. who's being joyous and clowny and then very serious when we're doing the actual scenes, I think the courtroom appreciated the involvement. Absolutely. Which you should be able to. We're all making the show together. Everyone in that room, we're all making that show together. That was joyous. Yeah.
I have to admit, I'm always suspicious of Donald Sutherland whenever he shows up anywhere. So I've got my eye on him, for sure. Well, thank you so much for the chat. I really appreciate it.
I really appreciate that, Joanna. Thank you so much. Take care, my lovely. Brilliant.
Bye.
Okay.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So I really agree with you. I think this show is enjoying unrolling to us the various ways in which these characters wield power. Like John, like ending the episode last week with Jonathan, like, you know, getting into a prison yard scrap, right? And then in this episode, Haley does a really good job of just sort of analyzing what his charm is. You know, she's just really, you know, sussing him up, reading him, and understanding how she can weaponize the charm the same way that he has weaponized it his entire life, in order to help them win the case in the media, which I think is a really interesting aspect of modern justice, the way in which the media can be a tool to, you know, help even the guiltiest of parties.
Yeah, and I think that the scene with Jonathan and Haley, when she's like, what the hell were you thinking going to the house?
Right.
That's powerful too, but also just the actual scene and thinking about it in the context of the lawyer scene where it's like, he, you know, him sort of doing the doctorly tenderness to the kid and just really insisting himself into these people's lives in a place
yes.
he's not wanted. And just thinking he can do it because, well, he knows better, he's smarter, he's sharper. I mean, really what that pair of scenes made me hope for the end of this show is I really hope it ends on Miguel, you know, in some fashion, because that kid is so caught up in this but has no power, no agency really, and is someone who I think it's, you know, we haven't heard from. I mean, he's barely spoken.
Yeah.
And is barely considered. Obviously, there's a lot of attention on this baby because of the paternity, but, you know, and obviously the confrontation at school, but the confrontation at school then becomes more about Grace's family and not about Miguel. And, you know, so I hope that the show finds a way more than it already has, which I think it subtly has, to recognize that kid who is so lost in this and so routinely affected by it in traumatizing ways.
I really like that assessment, but I do think that examination of Jonathan in this episode where, you know, he jams his foot in Fernando's door and insists that he can just come in and just ignores everything that Fernando says, and just like the audacity of his behavior in that house, touching Miguel at all, like any of that. And then he does a similar thing though in Grace's hospital room, right? Like he just like walks in.
Mm-hmm.
He's sort of been excised from the family, but he's just like, no, this is my place. You know, plays the doctor. That's sort of like a trick of his, right? Is like, let me do a doctor examination. I'm a trusted figure. I know things. Like, let me into your inner circle, kind of thing. And I think that is really interesting to show it to us twice in this episode.
Yeah, and you know, I remember reading something about like concerns over sociopaths in the medical industry, and it said last week about the God complex and all that. And I think that like we tend to think of doctors as carers, as healers, and they are that certainly, obviously. But in certain, and as in any profession, or most professions, especially high intensity ones, like people who are addicted to that intensity, addicted to that adoration, like can definitely, you know, sneak in. I also think, you know, Jonathan saying to Haley, I didn't see the harm in it. And it's like, you didn't
right.
see the harm in going,
right.
to, you know, I was thinking about that, you know, the interview that Prince Andrew gave about the whole Jeffrey Epstein situation, which was such a disaster.
Right.
They're just like, what the hell are you thinking? Like, how can you think this is possibly going well for you? But he exists in a world free of consequence,
yeah.
and also interrogation. Like, people never... He never say, hey, like, or confrontation. People never say, what this is, you are doing something wrong. I don't mean morally wrong. I mean, like, you were making an error. And so I think just, well, I didn't see the harm in it. And it's like, well, then you are a lost cause, because there's a lot of harm, you know, harm there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that examining Jonathan's performance in that interview. The Connie Chung interview was really interesting because, you know, he's doing this whole thing. And I mean, like, I don't know how we're meant to feel. I don't know how anyone listening here feels about his guilt or innocence. But just no matter what, even if I think he's innocent, I think that was a performance. And I think it was so staged when he's like, oh, may I? And then, you know, Haley tells him to go on and then he cries. I mean, come on. That's how I feel about that. I thought it was really chilling. And Grace's reaction seemed less to be about like, this is a performance, and more like, he said he loved this woman and that is really upsetting to me. But if I were at home, I'd be like, oh, bravo, Jonathan, Dr. Jonathan, Oscar worthy. Tears on Connie Chung. It reminded me of William Hurt in Broadcast News, you know, where it's like cut to this performative crying. I don't know. That's my read on it.
Or Nick's performative interview in Gone Girl, which is really to send a message to one person. So this is a different dynamic in this show, but like that sort of the falseness of media and how you can manipulate it and exploit it. And, you know, Haley says it's a chance for people to hear your side without cross. You know, so there is not going to be any, there won't be too many hard questions, even though Connie Chung was sort of known for that in parts of her career. But I think that it's become really clear that this whole family, this whole rarefied world they live in is a lot of show, a lot of manipulation, a lot of keeping up appearances, you know, to destructive, you know, with destructive means, and that maybe the ultimate undoing is kind of the exposing of that. And meanwhile, you have Miguel and you have his father, Fernando, who is dealing with something, I mean, many things that are really difficult, including like how to figure out how to love this kid and that is, you know, not biologically his, and, you know, might be, you know, the son of the person who killed his mother. You know, it's like, it's so complicated, and yet we're spending all this time on Connie Chung interviews and, you know, fancy private school spats, and I think that is deliberate on the show's part.
Absolutely. And I think what's interesting, Susanna Beer said this really interesting thing about how she thought that Hugh Grant had this like sadness or dark, I don't want to misquote her, because I think she and I, like, it took a little time for me to really understand what she was saying thematically, but like that she feels like Hugh Grant as an actor, as a performer, has sort of like weaponized this core, maybe it's like a hangdog sort of thing, and that it has worked through, like, through his sort of foppish mumbling rom-com intro to our lives, through some of, like, you know, his more recent performances, which have maybe been, you know, and then he went through like the cad phase after he was in Bridget Jones. And then like, now it's sort of like Hugh Grant could do whatever. Cause I remember in the 90s, there was a sense that Hugh Grant could only do like, my hair is falling over my forehead, I'm stammering, I'm so charming sort of thing. And then he did Bridget Jones that kind of like blew that image up a bit. And then I think in later years, we discussed some of his more recent performances on this podcast already that, like, you know, I kind of feel like Hugh Grant, there's just so much he can do. And so she was talking about this sort of like weaponized sadness, though, that runs through all of it. And I thought that was, I had never really considered that for him. And because we talked about weaponized charm for him, this idea of weaponized sadness, and that, you know, and that's something that he is doing in this, like, as Jonathan. I feel like if you watch Hugh Grant's like forehead eyebrow acting, like, oh, Jonathan is just forever like got this like wounded puppy dog eyebrow thing going on. He's just always like, why would you attack me? I'm innocent. I'm the victim. I'm like, it's me, you know, like or like even when I'm admitting to having cheated on my wife, it's just sort of this like, I know I'm awful, I'm a dirtbag, I know, but I'm not a murderer, like all this sort of stuff. Like, I just think it's a fascinating performance.
And watching people who know that tactic sort of throw it back in his face. I mean, you know, the scene where Franklin goes to see him in prison and Jonathan turns on the whole, like, I'm going to make this right, that kind of noble, you know, like proper gentleman kind of thing. And Franklin's like, I don't want that. you know, because he knows it. He's attuned to this. And then he, you know, later is like, I saw myself in him.
Yeah.
And that's why we had this conflict. Yeah, I mean, I think the show has really developed some really interesting psychological portraits. I wish that we got more of Elena. I mean, I think we're getting it as she's kind of become this virtual character. Right. You know, and the
Simone.
Thing, yeah. 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 Well, yeah. I meant like in the playwriting sense of, she's Sim one or whatever. But you know, the thing with the portrait of Grace, like that's,
yeah.
if that story is such that like it, you know, that she was obsessed with her and painted this portrait of her after what would have, you know, I guess have been close observation from a distance. That's creepy. And like that character is allowed to be creepy, you know, because she is, you know, one of the few people of color in this cast of characters, and certainly lower on the socioeconomic ladder. Like, that doesn't mean that she needs to be some saint who is just kind of done in by these terrible rich people.
Right.
She can be complicated too, but I think the important thing is we realize, well, maybe that was really creepy. Maybe there was obsessive behavior, all the phone calls, the portrait painting, but what did the other side, particularly in what we're imagining now, Jonathan do to exploit that or to stoke it or to otherwise, you know, do as much harm, if not more.
It reminds me of another property we talked about over on Little Gold Men, which is Rebecca, right? This idea of like becoming obsessed with the other woman, like in a way of like, is it a sexual obsession? You know, like Grace has this, imagined interlude where Elena kisses her in the locker room. You know what I mean? Is it like a sexual obsession? Is it insecurity? What is this? Like, I can imagine if you're in a relationship with someone and they have a wife, like, you know, you're interested in who that woman is. To what degree are you interested? How does that manifest? And this is sort of the, you know, John, as Fernando sort of righteously points out, like, is Jonathan's tactic to paint Elena as like as unhinged in some way? And like what, you know, bullshit Fernando considers that to be. But that is sort of the case that Jonathan's making here. And, you know, the portrait only helps his case, I would say.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe we would all paint portraits of Nicole Kidman if we could. One scene that I wanted to sort of zero in on really quickly to speak to some of the Susanna Beer directing technique that we've been talking about a little bit on this podcast is the scene where the detectives show Grace the portrait on the phone. And I was just like, the actress have mentioned this technique that Susanna Beer has where she like will focus her camera on like an eyeball or, a hand or a cuff or whatever it is, something like really micro or macro, I suppose, to create an effect, to sort of put you in the more in the psychological space than in the casual calm observer space. And so the reveal of the portrait, like Detective Mendoza's hand comes out with the phone in it in like slow-mo, you know, and you just see the hand and the phone, and then you see Grace's eyes, just her eyes, and then, you know, you see, like, and it's just so like, it's so artistic and almost impressionistic, which is so interesting for like the plot that we're seeing here. And I mean, like, I would say that Big Little Lies is specifically in season one, Jean-Marc Vallée like did a lot of this sort of impressionistic camera work as well to put you in sort of a headspace, dream space. But I'm just wondering if any of that stuff is like sticking out to you, Richard, or if it's just sort of like part of the scenery for you.
No, I think the show definitely has taken, you know, the first episode with its kind of stately classical music and I think the filmmaking was so crisp and formal, and it's really gotten more and more artsy, I guess, for lack of a more interesting word. But like, like you're talking about these kind of, you know, I guess insert shots and like close-ups and all those things and this swirl of the anxiety attack, and I think it's clear that the show is trying to illustrate that the psychological landscape as we understood it in the first episode is actually not what's going on. And I think it's doing that. Yeah. In interesting, technical ways, you know, the really tight close up on, Franklin's face as he's telling the headmaster, like, you haven't seen, I forget the word, trouble or something, you know, right. In that really sinister way. Like, I think in some ways the camera is really plunging now into people's heads. I think that, would further support our idea about the unreliable narrators and unreliable protagonists and, you know, I think it's gotten really kind of stylistically interesting, in addition to the murder mystery.
I do want to talk about Franklin's, I suppose we can say cocksucker on this podcast.
Yeah. Well, he says it like very Canadian, you know, it's cocksucker or whatever he says.
I definitely wrote down Canadian accent in my notes there. But first I want to mention there is one more close-up shot that I just want to mention, which is right before Grace faints, we just get a shot of the ends of Nicole's hair, of that beautiful like red curly wig, like just the ends of her hair blowing in the like New York morning breeze, and it's beautiful. I think this is a really gorgeous show. Let's talk about the Coke Soaker, however it is that Donald Sutherland Canadianly pronounced it, monologue. This reminded me of like, I don't know, watching Brian Cox go off in Succession, or maybe even the late great Dame Diana Rigg going off on Game of Thrones. You love a like elder statesman dressing down scene. Let's just talk a little bit more about Franklin in this episode and what we learn about him.
Well, we learned what we, I think, painfully have to keep relearning over and over again, which is that like so many times people who are that wealthy didn't get there by being nice or moral or anything but sinister, frankly. And to go from doting father and grandfather who's just more, you know, like, oh, come stay with me and my maid will make you food, and there seems to, and I gave him money and he cries in that scene last week, you know. And I don't think that's all performance exactly, but clearly there is a much steelier almost cruel side. You know, I don't know that the headmaster was handling it right. I don't think we're supposed to think that like that Franklin's just coming in there and just dressing down someone who doesn't deserve it exactly. But like, I do think that when push comes to shove, someone like Franklin doesn't give a shit about a kid like Miguel at all. Like it's the Succession thing of no real people or something.
Yeah.
No real person involved, you know?
Yeah.
I think you have to have that sort of sociopathic outlook on the world to become a titan of whatever. Do we know where Franklin's money's from?
I don't know what sounds Canadian. Maple syrup. He's a maple syrup baron.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you have to kill all the other maple syrup people in in Ontario or whatever to, you know, like, I mean, metaphorically or not, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's a really captivating scene. Again, you know, we said this about Noah Jupe, but like, you don't put Donald Sutherland in the show just to kind of hover around the edges and do nothing.
Right.
And this was really the episode where you realize that he's a sinister person. That means Grace is from a sinister family. She had these kind of illusions about her parents' marriage that were shattered this week. But like, maybe she knew more than she let on there and just didn't refuse to admit it to herself or whatever. But, clearly the rot is not only on Jonathan's side of things.
Yeah. It's interesting. One thing I want to say is that I feel like it's kind of plain that they had like maybe a day to shoot in that art gallery. And so they're like, let's get as much out of it as we can. So it's just sort of like the idea that Franklin goes to the museum every day is one of my favorite aspects of this show. Forever in an art gallery. Please don't let my non-New York ignorance show through. Is that a gallery you recognize?
Looked like the Frick to me, which is a used to be a private mansion by one of the, you know, Gilded Age barons that became a museum. I don't go up to that part of Manhattan often, so I don't really know.
It does seem frickish. I would agree with that. And yeah, and so just like all these scenes with him, I find so interesting. He, like, you know, the most apparent way they're trying to, like, make us think that he could be the killer is he threatens to kill Jonathan, and I kind of believe him in the jail interaction. So there's that. But yeah, just this idea, this conversation he has with Grace over another chess game, where he talks about how he didn't love her mother and how that was a delusion, you know, like a facade. And that Grace's whole idea of what a happy marriage or that love looks like was based on a lie. This is obviously undoing, something is undone for her here. But it also speaks to Franklin's ability to mask and to perform, which, you know, is something we shouldn't ignore, probably.
Yeah, you know, and I think that rich men often get described as great men because we have so little cultural right. ability or willingness to understand people beyond economic success, you know, and he's not a great man. He knows it, but he's also not afraid to not be, you know, he's not afraid to show to people like the headmaster that he isn't, you know.
The other thing I want to mention is Henry in this episode. We see him just, and throughout the series, we've just seen him a lot on the, like, fringes of conversations, watching them. We see him watching again in this episode. So I just think that that's worth noting, that, like, you know, little pitchers have big ears. Like, Henry is forever looking and watching and snooping and absorbing. And that's just something, once again, I'm waiting for the other Noah Jupe shoe to drop because what else is he here, kind of thing. So
his violin playing seemed to get better too. And I like that violin scene a lot because, you know, it's the grandfather kind of assessing the heir, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the kid says, well, a lot of the other kids want to play the drums or the bass or guitar, but I like the violin. It's different. And you're like, fuck you, you smarmy little, like that's a sort of precocious thing to say. Like, it's
the
annoying.
Violin is not that different also, by the way.
Like, every kid, I mean, it's the recorder, then violin or piano. I mean, it's not, yeah. You know, if you're going that route as a kid. That's not, obviously not 100% true, but it felt so smarmy. It felt like he was doing it to suck up to his grandfather. And then you're like, wait, is this kid, like, also putting on an act, you know? Or has he just learned how to do that from his dad and his grandfather through osmosis and doesn't know he's doing it. But, like, that very, like, well, thank you, grandfather, I'm very, you know, I'm so perfect thing was kind of chilling.
And I'm trying to assess his interaction with Miguel, which did read to me as completely incidental, like accidental.
Yes.
That he bumped
into Miguel.
I don't
think he's evil.
Yeah,
and
he genuinely seemed to apologize. And then, like, his interaction with the headmaster seemed also genuine to me, where he was just sort of like, what did I do? I apologize. I bumped into it and I apologized, you know, sort of thing. So, yeah, just some questions floating around there. Is there anything else we want to talk about in this episode? You got your wish. Jonathan is out of jail, so we don't have to deal with that plot line anymore, necessarily.
Yeah, that's a relief.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. I like that the show, you know, we have two episodes left. I really have no sense of where it's headed. I really have no sense of how big the, like, quote, the social or economic critique is going to be. It's already plenty there, but, like, I'm curious how the show will sort of frame itself at the end. And I don't know. I remain suspicious of everyone, but I don't know. I'm still pinning it on Jupe.
I got my eye on you, Jupe. Let's go to our interview with Ismael Cruz Cordoba, who, as I said, Fernando and Jonathan have this great, I think, just a really, like, electric, tense scene in this episode. So let's hear what he has to say about that. One of my favorite, you know, you've got some great dialogue scenes, but some of my favorite stuff you do is completely silent, sort of brooding, glowering, processing, emoting, all of that. And I was wondering if you could talk to me a little bit about your process or any conversations you had with Susanna about those silent moments for your character.
You know, when I read the script, the first thing that you read is, as you said, the dialogue, and it's so clear, you know, David wrote, but from the source material, it's clear to me, but I have to make the distinction as well, because you connect with certain characters and others you don't. And, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of them connect through your own personal experience. And I immediately, that one definitely did. And then going into the process with Susanna, you know, she's a master, and I think she could safely say she has an obsession for truth and honesty. And I'm looking for the nuance and the complexity of human emotion. So we're not only verbal beings, you know. So I think the way that she set up the space for us, you know, we had table reads, we had time to build chemistry, and in that time, she made it very clear that she was the leader, you know, and also that in a most beautiful way. Mm-hmm. So in order that trust was there. So I think in the way that she directed, she allows for a lot of silence as well. You know, she's not rushing, okay, let's go beat to beat to beat. This is the thing that we have to punch here, punch here, punch there, punch there.
Right.
You know, we would have rehearsal in the morning as well on top for about an hour. And then the set, it was a fade in. Because sometimes, I don't know if you've ever been on set and they shout, I got you.
Yeah.
It was kind of like that. She set everything up. An incredible group of artists that I think she's worked with before, several of them. So it would fade into performance, and she would massage that, conduct that as you went, and she would let that roll. So it really allowed you to start having your body affected by it, to live in the silence, to be in the set. I personally enjoy very much nonverbal act, like physical performance, physical based acting. You know, if you see other of my stuff, there's a through line in. In that, I do love. I didn't before as an actor. You're like, oh my god, I don't have a lot of lines. You're right. In a script, you're like, but through it all, I've learned the presence, the unspoken, the acting. Acting is what happens in between those lines as well. So I love that's coming across, because there's so much like this. You saw there's so much. How do you process all of that?
No.
At the same time, it's unspoken. It's nothing to be spoken. Like, you cannot have any words.
Right.
Like, while you have to go through those emotions, while having these children around, while still having to face life, it's like it was a convulsing feeling, and it truly was. Like, I was going through that while I was doing it.
So for that slow sort of warm up. Approach, would she just have you move through the space, move through the set, sort of, you know, do some things before you started the actual action? I'm just trying to, this sounds fascinating to me. I'm just trying to.
It was fascinating. I'm more than happy to share, because it was amazing. It was beautiful. You know, first, I think it's just I still have to continue to talk about the coming together of the elements, because when you set foot on the set, the costume was fantastic already, you know. The set design was fantastic. The lighting, where the crew was set up, already the rehearsal process, you know. So we would go in the morning and just rehearse whomever it was and her. That's it. Nobody else. So you're having an experience of the clean set that mm-hmm. doesn't have the million cameras. So that embeds in you. It's a very important thing. I like that. I like personally to go to set and be impacted by the set without all the machinery.
Yeah.
Because even when you put it later on, you still have the experience and the memory of it. So she will do that in the mornings. Like, everything stops. It's her and her actors. And she keeps, it's a thing, she keeps massaging it until she finds the truth. She's very against gratuitous sentimentality, you know?
Yeah.
Which we could definitely, I definitely went into at some point, very early on. She came right in and she's like, that's not what we're doing. Like, you know. But beyond that, she lets you be, you know? She creates a very precise structure, but lets you live within that structure. So I remember sitting on my kitchen, like, for, you know, nobody tells you have to be here, you have to be there. Everybody was so respectful of the performance. The actors were incredibly respectful of the performance. I mean, working with Nicole was just a dream come true in so many ways. But just as an actor, the generosity and as part of this world that you're responding to. So yeah, I mean, I wish it could be there. I hope you get a little glimpse of it while I'm describing it.
Was your, you know, you're not the only actor on the show to talk about Susanna sort of like reining them back a little from their original conception of the character, that they wanted to go bigger and she wanted to keep it sort of reined in. Was your perception of the character significantly different when you read it versus after hearing what Susanna wanted from you in this performance?
I mean, I think the devastating healing that he was going through, plus then if it runs after four, at the same time that, you know, there's holding the sweetest, most innocent child, you know, and this rage. Well, that I didn't know I was going to have a real live baby in that scene.
Oh, really?
Like those elements, you know, going with them, allowing them to impact you. She would do things, very small things, like you think you're going to be in a scene where the door is closed and nobody can hear you. She said, no, the door's going to be halfway open. So that completely changes the tone of everything, because you have to go at it at a person, but you don't want people to hear you. Plus, there's a child. Plus, like, it truly messed me up in the best of ways. Because it was about death. You know, this in just like the writing that was so nuanced. We as humans, when you start crying, what's the first thing that you do? You're just like, ooh, ooh, you hide. You know,
right.
You're not consistently trying to do those things outwardly. You know, position yourself so that everybody sees you crying. It can be a choice, but that's a tactic on its own. See me. You know, mm-hmm. But what we do is like everything goes inside. So like that was, and from there, if it comes back, it comes in a different way. So that was like a lot of the process, just restraint until you can't anymore, you know, which poetically it's the show, you know, what you bring in until those things start coming out of the cracks.
Yeah.
Intimacy is terrifying, I think, for absolutely every human that I've met. So, you know, so I think the one-on-ones were harder.
Yeah.
So you can get lost in a crowd. So and intimacy with these people, because I'm also, you know, Susanna Bier and Nicole Kidman in a room with you, or Susanna Bier and Hugh Grant with you in a room. But that said, just going back to, you know, gushing, the actors, they're so committed to the work. And so generous. So they gave me everything. You know, they gave me everything that I needed to be able to go deep. All the energy, all the commitment, all the focus, the respect, the space for my ideas, the space to breathe, the space to take my time, and the verbal also permission. You know, Nicole, at one point, I did something in one scene that I got a bit self-conscious. Did I scare someone? Did I cross a boundary? And she just looks at me and just goes, do your thing. She goes, like, do what you got to do. Don't worry about me. And that was fantastic. In the courtroom scenes, I had to operate a bit differently, because it's just, I automatically, I engage a lot with extras and crew, because I was an extra for a long time and I love my crew. And I don't like the hierarchy, and like you don't look at certain people. But in that, I end up sometimes wasting a lot of my energy, and I you can't do that with this role, you know.
Yeah.
You know, in that scene that you're mentioning, I had to stay in a very, very protected space. So it was one of the first times in my life that I would just have headphones, why not, you know, in the stand, and. You know, they would kind of give me a signal so I could. So I would, when I was in the stand, I didn't engage much with anyone.
Can you share what you listen to in your headphones when you're trying to stay in your space? Because I have to tell you, Hugh Grant's answer to that question was priceless to me. So I'm curious what you listen to. Or is it just a white noise?
I was going to say, absolutely not.
No. You won't share.
No. I actually have, it's just random. There's this random playlist that I have of songs that get me so freaking sad. But you would never think that those, like really? So it's not like a regular sad song. They just, they have a moment, whether it's the voice when it climbs and it, you know, like it raises your, you know, that song.
Yeah.
Those songs, it doesn't matter, like something they do with their voice or when the cellos come in or when the bass drops, there's something that just like opens you up. So yeah. I do have a song, I'm in there from Cirque du Soleil.
Really?
Oh my God. And I don't know what language she's speaking, but there's a point where she's like, she keeps changing keys and she does something with like her voice that always disarms me. Absolutely every time. And then there's another one from the singer, Australian, Aboriginal singer, Christine Anu, that she sang in the opening of the Olympics, Sydney 2000.
Nice.
And there's a recording of that, right? There's a recording of like the studio recording, but the one that gets me is when she sang it at the opening ceremony.
The live. All right.
So it's that one, even when you hear the crowd and you hear the announcer present her in the languages, and then she starts that one.
It's over for you.
Like, so yeah, so I would listen to those. They remind me of very important times of my life.
Yeah,
that one when I moved to New York actually, and I had nothing and I was just like hanging on a dream, and it gives me this, it's called My Island Home, you know. So, and I come from Puerto Rico, so it just speaks so beautifully of like a guy going from the mountains into the sea. Ah, you see, I start.
Oh no.
It's beautiful.
I wanted to ask you, you mentioned sort of the social disparity that's at play in this story, and there's also a racial disparity. We've got this like hyper white family at the center and then these non-white characters sort of orbiting them. And I'm wondering, you know, what you think the show has to say about the way in which those worlds interact around this story.
Yeah, I mean, my experience within New York and in life, but New York mainly, is how harmoniously they, in a certain way, they live in New York. You know, we're all transit the same streets, take the same subway cars, but how, strikingly we, and how stark it is, there's no relation, you know, there's no mixing, there's no... You know, the same people get off at the same stop and you're going to the same party, but one's going to be your cater waiter and the other one's the biggest benefactor, you know? So, and how, you know, the displacement of that and how keeps pushing people out to the outer boroughs. And it's like, there's being together, but there's no togetherness, you know, close to each other, but there's no actual melding. Rarely, you know, very rarely does that happen. But what was fascinating to me too, and also growing, just becoming an adult and all these things, is that you do aspire to be in those upper echelons. You know, when you grow up poor, you say, oh my God, if I had the this and the that. And the more you go into those spaces, even as a, you know, bystander, I've questioned myself. I think, who's the lucky one? I think I'm the lucky one. I think I've gotten to see the rawness of the world throughout, versus that feels more like a prison, both psychological and materialistic prison. That, you know, they kind of build these pyramids up on their heads that eventually somehow always fall.
Well, on that note, I wanted to ask you, this is a question I've been asking some folks. What do you make of the title of this series, The Undoing? Like, what is undone? You talk about like pyramids toppling and stuff like that. Is it that? What is your view on that?
Listen, if you ever had any breakup, yeah, that thing that breaks in you afterwards when you start recontextualizing everything. What was what?
Yeah.
Was that real? Was that not real? What moments were real? Was it love? Were we actually in love? Was I getting love back? You know, like the recontextualizing of your entire being, like how we're actually able to live on narratives, live on assumptions, live on attachments, and then all of a sudden that whole thing comes out and from under you. And I think that to me is the undoing. It's it's not only something that happens outside, because if, for example, I mean, the show or I mentioned as an example, a breakup, that broke over there, is how that topples and reconfigures your entire identity, sense of self, you know? Yeah. So I think that's what every character is going on in the show.
Yeah.
It's going through in the show, you know?
I think that's right. So, what difference do you think it makes for this show to be coming out now in the world we're living in now versus, you know, it was supposed to come out in the spring? It feels like we're in an entirely different universe now from where we were when this was supposed to originally drop. So, you know, have you put any thought into how differently the story might land now with folks?
Definitely. I think I have a hope and also like an assumption, just coming from myself. I hope that everyone who has a beating heart and it's mildly functioning mind was affected by this pandemic, you know, by what happened and how we have been introduced to time to be introspective and to be with ourselves and to connect with our humanity. So I think that people, at least the people that I'm surrounding myself, and you see, I mean, these, for example, the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, gained so much momentum. It's been all around,
right.
But so many elements of it, I feel like that a lot of people, a lot of white people were finally at home as well and got in touch with a certain type of humanity that when they saw, for example, you know, George Floyd, they said, a whole different context when you're closer to your humanity, you know, that I think that really affected people because they no longer saw just that far away person. It's like, no, that human, that pain, this that I'm feeling for the first time in my life, because I'm sitting with myself all day, where they were finally able to receive it. So, and I don't think that was a coincidence, you know? I personally have gone through an entire transformation, and I feel like I've accessed my voice and many things that I had buried down in the pursuit of success or whatever. So I do feel that this show, you know, comes at the right time to be able, because it's all about humans and the complexity of it, and there's so much humanity to it. But also it's a commentary on the mediatic system and the legal system, you know? So like coming from all these events that we've had, it also makes you question that process. And I think it comes perfectly after the whole thing that we've been going through to look at the cracks within those two systems, you know, if anything. What do you think?
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right about everything you said, especially the humanity and the attention that we were able to give. We're usually so distracted, right? And if you're stuck in your home, you can't distract yourself from the realities of what you're seeing. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I love talking to you and I love your work.
Thank you.
So thank you. All right. Well, that does it for us this week. I guess I do want to mention one last thing, which is that, you know, we're constantly, a lot of the media things that we are seeing is like through Henry watching on his tablet or whatever, right? Yeah. And in this episode, we get the very specific mention of the white privilege of Jonathan, which is something, you know, I've talked to a lot of our interviewees about, but just something that I just think is interesting that, like, you know, Haley is not white, Fernando's not white, the detective's not white, like, blah, blah, blah. And at the center of it, you have this, like, very lily white family plus Lily Rabe. You know what I mean? It's like, but everyone else around them, you know, for the most part is not white. And I think that that is a really interesting casting choice and a really interesting, you know, I don't think this is a political show, but it is a show that is about, you know, halls of power and the way in which those halls of power are often, you know, codified by racial privilege. Is it?
Yeah. And Franklin saying of this very intelligent, high powered lawyer, she's a car mechanic. She just does what she fixes things. you know, it's such a utilitarian transactional view of a person, you know. And that was, yeah, pretty telling.
All right. So until we do our Zoop check-in next week, Richard, where can folks find you?
Well, I'm going to be practicing my drums because I guess I'm a basic asshole. Sorry, Henry. Sheesh. While I'm not doing that, I will be tweeting at Rylaws and reviewing things for VF.com. Joanna, where can we find you until next week?
Oh, I'll be in my basement working on my portrait of Nicole Kidman. It's totally fine. This is fine. Don't worry about it.
Oh, I thought it was going to be of me.
Aw. You can be next. Until then, you can find me on Twitter at JoWriteThis or VF.com. And we will see you in wandering around Central Park next week.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ Audio Network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.